Imagine this. You've got 30 seconds on national television to share the most interesting thing about yourself. What do you say?
This young man doesn't eat fruit. Ellen Hostetter used an infrared camera to do what?
I want to know about your cat.
Says here that your father got a phone call from a young girl who was looking for...
Justin Timberlake.
Our producer, Brent Bachman, is obsessed with Jeopardy, especially these personal anecdotes. He reports on how the smartest people on television survive the most nerve-wracking 30 seconds of their lives.
The first key to your survival on Jeopardy? Maggie, speak.
Hey, Brent, how are you?
Maggie and Robert James, not James Robert.
That happens to you, like, every day, I bet.
Every day of my life.
These two, Maggie and Robert, are a Jeopardy contestant's best friends. They're the show's contestant coordinators.
Yeah, they're your lifeline. They're your best friends. And they're wonderful. They're really, really good at their jobs.
Trisha McKinney was a contestant on the show back in 2007. She was excited to land a spot until she received her three-page contestant questionnaire from Maggie and Robert. Do you have the sheet in front of you there?
I have. Yes, I do. Point A, be brief. Really, we're looking for one-liners. After all, that's the real reason we're here, to win lots of money. And surprise us. Tell us something about yourself or something you've done that no one else would guess about you.
Have you ever been at a turning point in your career?
Brushes with greatness and secret ambitions?
What's the most romantic thing you've ever done?
Man, it's all coming back to me when you read me that.
Here are some memorable examples from last season. Fabio saved my life. I broke my toe while chasing a bear.
I just panicked.
I used to recruit spies for the CIA.
I panicked. I remember agonizing.
Hours and hours and hours.
I love you, Alex Trebek. I wanted to be cool.
I didn't do it just right.
I wanted to come up with something.
Make Alex Trebek say, I want to be your best friend.
And that's totally not what happened.
If you didn't get some of those examples of good anecdotes, I once broke my toe while chasing a bear. I used to recruit spies for the CIA. That's the bar you get as a contestant. People who run toward bears, not away from them. CIA spies. So before the show, Robert James sits down with each contestant to settle on three of their best anecdotes from the questionnaire. That often requires more work. Once, after responding to all the questions on the form, a contestant settled on the most interesting thing he could share. I like to walk.
I like to walk, but we all like to walk. You know, we got to come up with something more. And we worked with him, and he came with some good stories. People don't often realize what's interesting about themselves.
All this happens before the contestants make it to their taping. And when they get there, here's Trisha McKinney again.
We were so excited to be there and to meet Alex Trebek. He's like a rock star.
So you have meeting a rock star nerves. And here's the other thing. Jeopardy tapes 5 shows a day. That means as a player, you could potentially win 5 times, which means 5 changes of clothes, 5 personal anecdotes, and 5 games worth of contestants all in the same room.
12 really twitchy, crazy people who are all dying to go on TV and be famous and win a lot of money. Everybody in the room wants to beat everybody else in the room.
So the contestant coordinators step in again.
And so they have to just spend probably a good half a day just calming everybody down. They sit with you, just making sure nobody throws up.
People tell me that, you know, they're thrilled to play the game. A lot of people are like, this is the scariest part, is this chat thing. But the thing is, Alex is so good at his job. He will bail you out.
This is Dan Sussman's anecdote. He was on the show December 28th, 2004.
Maryland. Most people, when they think of Africa and wildlife in Africa, think of lions.
He built it up as a very dramatic experience.
Well, my dad's from South Africa, so we go over there occasionally. And we're fishing on a lake in Botswana when I noticed that there was a new island moving towards us. And it was a hippopotamus chasing us. So that was a little scary. I think
more. And then, just like that, it's gone.
Yeah, and you can focus back on the game, on the score. The other people next year are going to bobble the questions themselves.
Did you feel as nervous during the actual quiz portion of the show as you did during the story?
Not at all. I know how to answer questions.
In a way, it's comforting that there are still people in America who simply have no idea what to do with themselves in front of a camera. People who have the humility to be nervous, they're taking up your time. Dan Sussman didn't win his game. Trisha McKinney did. She won 3 times, over $50,000. She remembers the last story she told.
was a story about my cousin and me. We went to Germany, and we found this shop that we really liked, but it was closed, so we were going to come back another day. So we tried to memorize the name of the street the shop was on, and so we memorized the name Einbahnstraße, which we later came to find out means one-way street in German.
Why is that funny?
Because there's a lot of one-way streets.
Oh, okay.
I know, right? This is the quality anecdote that I had to work with.
Of course, Maggie Speak says it's easy to make fun of someone else's story.
What would you talk about?
Don't ask me that.
Have you been anywhere interesting?
See, this is like, I could not do it.
Producer Brent Baughman isn't going on Jeopardy anytime soon.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. President Obama wades into the discussions over the deficit today. After weeks of leaving deficit reduction talks to Vice President Biden, Mr. Obama will meet personally with Republican and Democratic leaders of the Senate. They're trying to work out a plan to stem the tide of red ink. No matter what happens, the government will still need to keep borrowing money, and that means lawmakers will need to raise the federal debt ceiling within the next 5 weeks. Joining us now to talk about the budget wrangling and other political news is NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley. Good morning.
Good morning, Renee.
Now, Scott, the president's personal involvement in the deficit talks comes after negotiations between the vice president and lawmakers hit a wall last week when the House Republican leader Eric Cantor walked out. So where do things stand as of this morning?
That's right. Eric Cantor announced last Thursday that he would no longer take part in these talks because he said Democrats are insisting that any deficit reduction package include not only spending cuts, but also tax increases. Now, every bipartisan group that's looked at the deficit has said the same thing, but Republicans argue tax hikes should not be on the table. Here's Senator Mitch McConnell speaking yesterday on ABC's This Week.
Throwing more tax revenue into the mix is simply not going to produce a desirable result, but it won't pass. I mean, putting aside the fact that Republicans don't like to raise taxes, Democrats don't like to either.
That's true. You know, neither party likes to raise taxes, and unfortunately, both parties like to spend money, which is how we wound up in the situation we're in. Government spending is historically high right now relative to the size of the economy. At the same time, tax revenues relative to the size of the economy are at their lowest level in decades. So the White House says it's going to take both spending cuts and tax increases to bridge that gap. That's the case Mr. Obama will try to make today when he meets with Senator McConnell.
And all of this coming to a head now because of the debt ceiling.
Right. We've actually been sort of brushing our head up against the debt ceiling for weeks now, and the Treasury Department's been moving money and IOUs around to keep us from breaking through. They can do that for another month or so, but the Treasury estimates they're going to run out of wiggle room about August 2nd. So they really need lawmakers to raise the debt ceiling, giving the government a bigger credit card before then. The thing is, it's always unpopular to raise the debt ceiling, but every budget that's out there, including Republican Congressman Paul Ryan's, would require the government to keep borrowing money for years to come. So the debt ceiling must be raised. The question is, what kind of political cover can lawmakers extract in return? And they don't have a whole lot of time to figure it out. You know, the House is not in session this week. The Senate will be out next week. And so by the time they're both back at work, you're going to have about 3 weeks to make a deal.
And Scott, tomorrow President Obama will visit an Alcoa factory which produces aluminum. It's part of his push for advanced manufacturing, isn't it?
That's right. You know, manufacturing has been one of the relatively bright spots in the otherwise tepid recovery. There have been about 240,000 manufacturing jobs added in the last year and a half. And the president wants to encourage that. It's part of sort of a not just fixing the short-term economy, but really mending the longer-term trends in the economy. And so he's going to be talking about the benefits of advanced manufacturing, something he talked about on Friday as well. And he's going to be touring a factory that makes advanced alloys used in things like Boeing and Airbus jets. And, Renee, it just so happens that factory is in the swing state of Iowa.
And it just so happens that in Iowa, the president will have some competition of sorts, Republican Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann.
That's right. Michelle Bachmann will be announcing her presidential campaign in Iowa, for anyone who might have missed her announcement during last week's GOP debate. And Bachman, who is an Iowa native, does very well in a new poll from the Des Moines Register of likely GOP caucus goers. She is basically tied in the lead with Mitt Romney, far ahead of the rest of the field. Her brand of Christian conservatism plays very well with the homeschoolers and others who sort of dominate the Republican caucus crowd in Iowa. So she'll be campaigning there. And then just to stir the pot, Sarah Palin will be in Iowa later this week.
NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. It's Monday. Oh, wait a minute. I mean, it's Monday. If you don't live in a major city, it can be hard to find medical specialists, and that is especially true for people with chronic disorders like Parkinson's disease who need frequent care. And today in Your Health, we look at patients who are turning to specialists hundreds of miles away to get the attention they need by video. Doctors and patients like the video appointments, but insurance companies are not yet convinced. NPR's Nancy Shute reports.
Deanna Ventura was seeing a neurologist for her Parkinson's, but she was still having trouble walking, bathing, and doing her housework.
I knew that I needed more than what he was doing for me.
Managing Parkinson's symptoms is a tricky business, and the drugs used can have serious side effects. You need a specialist. But for Ventura, the closest was 2 hours away from her home in upstate New York, and she doesn't drive. So the specialist comes to her.
So I last saw you in February, and have you been doing since February?
If it sounds like Ray Dorsey is far away, that's because he is, 343 miles away at Johns Hopkins Medical Center in Baltimore. He's a movement disorder specialist, and he's been Ventura's doctor for the last 4 years.
How about your Parkinson's disease? Any complaints related to your Parkinson's?
I find that I drop things a lot more. I'm finding that my balance is worse, which wasn't good anyways.
Ventura is 68 years old, a cheerful grandmother with white hair. She's sitting in the conference room of a nursing home just down the street from her apartment in New Hartford, New York. She sees the doctor on a flat-screen TV. He can see her on his laptop. It's healthcare by video call.
Do you know what today's date is?
Yes, today is May 20th, and the year is 2011.
And who's the Secretary of State?
Hillary Clinton.
Pretty good.
People with Parkinson's can have trouble with memory and speech. They often have tremors and stiff movements. So Dorsey needs to test Ms. Ventura's motor skills.
Can I see you put your hands out like this?
He sticks his hands straight out and holds them steady. Ventura tries it.
So you have a little bit of shaking in your right hand.
Yes.
By observing that tremor in each visit, Dorsey can get a good sense of the disease's progression. He checks on her medications, too.
So you look good as usual, Ms. Ventura.
Thank you.
The one thing I want you to work on is exercise. How are we doing on that front?
He can see his patient's guilty smile.
My hesitation tells you.
Studies of telemedicine have found that the care patients receive is at least as good as in-office visits. Patients also say it's much more convenient, and it's often cheaper. Ventura thinks she knows why.
Believe me when I tell you, he doesn't miss a thing. Because I never noticed that my lower chin was quivering.
But Dr. Dorsey, from 300 miles away, did notice, and he adjusted her medication to control the tremor. Ventura says her symptoms have improved to the point where she can now use a cane instead of a walker. And she's not the only patient who's happy. Tony Joseph is the administrator of the Presbyterian Home, which hosts the video visits.
The Parkinson's people said, Tony, this is better than when I used to go to the doctor's office because I'm spending actually more time with that neurologist.
But there is one big problem with specialty care via telemedicine. In most cases, insurance won't pay for it.
Right now, if I were to try to bill a Blue Cross Blue Shield or anybody else for a neurological consult like we're doing right now, they're not going to cover it.
So Tony Joseph has taken to running fundraisers to pay Dr. Dorsey and the other neurologist who provides Parkinson's care. That costs about $40,000 a year.
We do a Parkinson's awareness walk, and we've been very successful with that.
Those fundraisers have kept the New Hartford program going for 4 years. But why won't insurers pay for telemedicine? Dr. Jay Sanders helped pioneer remote health care in the 1990s.
Traditionally, payment has always been made based upon the physical presence of the doctor with the patient.
That's to protect against insurance fraud. And there's yet another stumbling block. doctors have to be licensed to practice in the state their patients live. Ray Dorsey knows that even if telemedicine overcame those barriers, it wouldn't cure all ills. That becomes clear during the video call, when Deanna Ventura reaches up to rub her neck.
It is restricting. I could feel it. And I haven't had this. This is something new for me.
This is one of the limitations of telemedicine is I can't fully assess your neck.
He doesn't think it's anything serious, but he wants someone to actually feel that neck. So he asked her to get it checked out by her family doctor.
Well, thank you, Dr. Dorsey. You take care of yourself and your family.
And we'll see you in August. Sandy will give you a time.
Making for a good visit, even from far away. Nancy Shute, NPR News.
In 2000, Sports Illustrated named its 100 top athletes of the 20th century. There are names you no doubt are familiar with, Babe Ruth, Muhammad Ali, and of course Michael Jordan. But there's also a name that stands out, Babe Diedrichson Zaharias. She's the only woman in the top 10.
Whenever anyone saw Babe, she was running, usually barefoot, and always pretty fast for a girl who couldn't have been more than 8 or 9. And the observant residents of Beaumont's South End figured Babe wasn't running to get somewhere on time. They figured she was fleeing the scene of her latest act of mischief.
That's Don Van Natta reading from his new book, Wonder Girl, The Magnificent Sporting Life of Babe Diedrichson Zaharias. In the 1920s and 30s, Babe Diedrichson proved a girl could be a phenomenal all-around athlete. After mastering basketball and track and field, she eventually turned to golf and won 3 U.S. Women's Open championships before she died of cancer when she was only 45 years old. This weekend, Babe Diedrichson would be 100 years old. Don Van Natta is here to talk about her legacy. Don, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, Rachel, for having me.
So the book makes reference to Babe's sporting life. It really was a life of sports. She didn't just excel in one, right?
No, she excelled at every sport she tried to play. She was an All-American basketball player who won the AAU basketball championship. She then branched out into track and field and won 3 medals at the 1932 Los Angeles Olympic Games. She excelled at baseball, swimming, softball, tennis, bowling. And finally, after a stint on the vaudeville stage and riding a donkey around a baseball diamond, she took up golf.
When did she know that she had this kind of talent?
It was at a very young age. At around the age of 12 or 13, she became aware of the Olympics, and she declared that she was going to become the greatest athlete of all time. Now, she didn't say woman athlete. She just said greatest athlete. And she never really was concerned with those gender issues or class issues. Those were hurdles that never really occurred to her.
But this was in a time, it was the 1920s, and women, you didn't exactly declare that and then go off and join a league and try to become a professional athlete. Tell me a little bit about how women were able to play sports. They played actually for businesses that said, you come work for us and then we'll put you on a team, right?
That's right. She went, Babe left high school and went to Dallas to join Employers Casualty Insurance. And at that time, in the late 20s and early 30s, women's basketball was big business, particularly in Texas. And Babe went initially and played basketball for the Employers Casualty team. And while at Employers Casualty, she took up track and field. In fact, one day she was out on a track and field at a stadium, and she saw what she thought was a spear lying on the ground, and she said, "What's that?" And she was told it was a javelin, and she started throwing it. And then just within a year and a half, Babe was sent by Colonel McCombs, who ran Employers Casualty Insurance's team, to Chicago to compete as a one-woman track team for a spot on the Olympic team.
So let me get this straight. There's a national championships that the winners of that would go on to the Olympics. Most companies who had these kinds of women's athletic teams were fielding a whole team. And this man, McCombs, just sent Babe Diedrichson?
Yes, he did. Much to the consternation of Babe's teammates, there were another dozen women that felt they should have been given the opportunity to go to Chicago and compete for a spot on the women's track and field team as well. But Colonel McCombs believed it would be a publicity bonanza for Employers Casualty, and he just felt that Babe could do it on her own, not only qualify for the Olympic team, but win the national championship against teams of 15, 18, 22 women all by herself.
And she did it.
Babe Diedrichson won 5 events within 3 hours, and single-handedly won the national track championship.
It's really amazing to think about that. I mean, you do reference, though, that her teammates weren't so happy about this. Babe Didrikson had an unbelievable ego. I mean, she had a lot of confidence in herself.
She knew at a very early age that she was good, not just better than all the little girls that she was competing against, but against all the little boys she was competing against. And she would get in the heads of her teammates. She would show up and say, you know, who's going to come in second today? Babe is here. And that overconfidence, really, she was a pain in the neck, I think intimidated many of her opponents throughout her career and really worked in her favor.
I'm talking with Don Van Natta about his book, Wonder Girl, The Magnificent Sporting Life of Babe Didrikson Zaharias. Her confidence is so remarkable, but there is this issue that comes to the fore about her gender. And all of a sudden, people start insinuating that she's very masculine, that she might be gay, that she's involved in all these sports because she can't catch a man. Did that get under her skin?
Oh, absolutely. The press turned on her in a vicious way. It was all men writing nasty things about her. Babe was not a very attractive woman, although, as she put it, she tried to be graceful. And it really did get under her skin. It bothered her a lot, but she dug in and just kept at it.
She eventually did fall in love, got married, and had a long marriage. She started playing golf seriously, though, not until later in her career. And that ended up being the sport that she's best known for. She would go on to win 3 U.S. Opens. She told people that she was a natural at golf. Was she a natural?
No. One of the great things about Babe that I really love about her personality is her self-promotion. And she really knew how to turn on members of the press corps with almost a fairy tale story. And she had played golf back in high school in Beaumont, Texas, on the golf team.
There's a little bit in here. There's kind of a con artist in there somewhere.
Oh, yeah. She definitely was a con artist. For instance, she would go out and, let's say, shoot an 80 on the golf course. She would tell the reporters that she shot a 71 or 72, and she would justify it by saying, well, they don't want to hear I shot an 80. They want to hear I shot a 71, and the press bought it.
Don Van Natta, Babe Didrikson should have been embraced as an American hero, but for much of her life, she was really seen as this kind of an oddball, even a freak. How has our image of her changed over time, do you think?
She's, I think, one of the great American forgotten athletic superstars. I went to Beaumont when I began research on this book 7 years ago, and there is a little museum there for Babe. It's a building that's just devoted only to Babe Didrikson. You can see her 2 gold medals and her silver medal, a key to Denver that was given to her after she won the women's amateur in Scotland. And I went there on a rainy day in November 2004, and I was the only visitor there that day. And I was really struck by that. This is a great story and a great icon. You know, before there was a Bo Jackson or a Michael Jordan or a Deion Sanders attempting to play 2 sports and actually not even playing the second one that well, Babe played all sports and excelled at all of them. And if she were alive today, her stardom would know no bounds, and she would have the biggest sneaker contract in history.
And probably a reality TV show.
Yes, right.
That's Don Van Natta, correspondent for The New York Times and author of Wonder Girl, The Magnificent Sporting Life of Babe Didrikson Zaharias. Don Van Natta, thanks very much.
Thank you, Rachel. Appreciate it.
Commentator Mark Lax sees most of his patients the old-fashioned way. He's a gerontologist, and Lax says his oldest patients aren't necessarily the most at risk.
I have a 98-year-old patient who's not only independent, but rather quite dashing. And he recently asked me a series of questions that reminded me of one of the most intriguing scientific papers in all of gerontology. Is it okay if he has a little cheese and butter from time to time? In modest amounts, he assured me. Is an occasional glass of wine okay? And, here's the kicker, is it still safe for him to make his annual solo pilgrimage to Switzerland, where he enjoys fresh air and a good hike? The answers? Yes, yes, and yes. Now look, advancing age is a risk factor for a variety of medical conditions, as well as shoving off this mortal coil. But what if I told you there's kind of an escape velocity, an age at which the risk of death and disability actually begins to fall? In a stunning paper a decade ago, James Vaupell of the Max Planck Institute looked at the evidence for this hypothesis in lower and higher organisms, yeast, fruit flies, worms, and yes, humans. And he came to this startling conclusion. At the extremes of age in all these species, rates of death actually drop. And here's the cherry on top finale of that paper. Vaupell decided to see if the data pattern is limited only to living things. So he looked at death rates for, are you ready for this? Automobiles. Here, death, quote unquote, was defined as when a car's owner stops registering it. And indeed, the same escape velocity pattern was seen with old clunkers. A subset of motor vehicles are simply unstoppable. The old Chevy or Honda that keeps going and going and going. Sure, it needs a few replacement parts over its long life, and it certainly gets dinged and dented. But after passing some astronomical odometer reading, the damn thing seems to be nearly indestructible. We've all had certain inspirational people in our lives who behave the same way. Stated differently, things and people in motion tend to stay in motion, and those that don't stop, or worse. And the older you get, the older you are likely going to get. So I'd argue that my 98-year-old patient's wish to take his annual stroll in the Alps is probably not only safe, but actually therapeutic. I'm not a Pollyanna. We all have to go sometime. But like many of my patients, he seems to have achieved escape velocity, and there's no reason for him to stop now. Maybe the comedian George Burns, when asked about the secret to his longevity, had it right, but for the wrong reason. The key, he said, is to make it to 100, because very rarely do you read about people dying after that age.
Commentator Mark Lax is director of geriatrics for the New York Presbyterian Healthcare System and professor of medicine at Weill Cornell Medical College. He's the author of Treat Me, Not My Age,